Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University and the studios of WMOT-FM, both in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. We are speaking today with one of your very own, WMOT's Randy O'Brien, a voice you know very well, fabled in story and song. What you might not know about Randy is that he also writes fiction.
True.
You have written screenplays.
True.
You have written a novel.
True.
And the novel that we are talking about today is called Judge Fogg. This has been sitting in a drawer, you said, for many, many years, but now you have finally been able to get it published. How so?
I was able to ask favors, twist arms, thumb screws on some people were used to get the manuscript read over the last 10 or 12 years.
Well, and I know you didn't have enough money to bribe anybody. No. You're a state employee.
No, I did not. But I was able to get the manuscript read by editors at major houses in New York. Major agents looked at it, and all of the large agencies in the United States, ICM, William Morris, and also CCA, they all had a chance at it, and they all said, hey, this is good, this is great, we thoroughly enjoy it, but it's not marketable. We can't find anybody that would want to put $50,000 to $100,000 into putting this book out. We just don't feel like there's a slot at the bookstore for it. So you're doing great work, but we're going to have to pass. So that's the way it works.
So how did you finally convince someone to take a chance on printing it in some form or other?
Well, now this is the interesting part, of course, is that the current publisher, LiteraryRoad.com, is an online publisher in that the editor is a mom. She has two kids. She has a husband who works. She has a cadre of people that she works as kind of freelancers and people that help her. But it's a very low overhead. It's pretty much all online. She has three titles that are available in print form, but most of them are only available online. In other words, they're available in the Adobe PDF form. There's a Microsoft reading file form, which I think is called LT or something like that. And she sells those online. And then when she contracts with an author to do a print-on-demand version of the novel that is available, she will contract Ingram here in Laverne, and they will set up an account, and they will have the software that basically lays out the book. I think it's called Glassbook. I'm not sure exactly what that is. I haven't really looked that far into it. But once that is set up at Ingram, the website in Seattle, the website Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the other online booksellers, if you go to those particular sites in the next few weeks maybe, you'll be able to see the cover of the book. You'll see a short sample of the book. You can order it, and it will be printed and delivered to your home the next day, just as if you were buying the Stephen King book that just came out last week, in that very same way.
So doing it this way, they minimize their printing cost. They don't have a gazillion of these stored in a warehouse somewhere,
exactly.
But they're still able to service the customer.
They do not have, 10 editors on staff. They do not have 50 promotional people. They don't have a promotional tour budget for their authors. They don't have, very high rent in New York City to pay. So in that sense, they've really done something revolutionary for the publishing business in that they can take a chance on something like my book, which is perceived as not being a viably commercial book because it's not a mainstream kind of title that can either be made into a series or anything like that. That's going to be an ongoing. It's a one-shot title. It's not an ongoing kind of series in that sense. So in the business sense, it's very low overhead. Even though they've done a great job with the layout, the cover, the promotion, the line edit, all that stuff was top notch. But their current overhead has to be thousands of dollars less than someone taking a chance on a first-time novel in New York City.
Now, we'll get into the sum and substance of the book in a minute, but what you're saying right now is really important, I think, for aspiring authors
exactly.
who might be in the same situation that you found yourself in, or wanting to figure out how do I break through that corporate mm-hmm. jungle. And it seems like you wrote it before the internet really took off
right.
in a mass appeal, mass accessibility kind of way.
Right.
And then when the internet became a truly egalitarian venue for all different kinds of people to get their messages across mm-hmm. or to be entrepreneurs, then it just was right time, right place.
I had a chance to give a talk the other day, and I started the talk by saying this is the best of times and this is the worst of times. In a real sense, this is the best of times because if you're an artist and you want to write a novel, you have no real constraints on the subject matter and the way that you want to handle the subject of the novel that you want to write in terms of trying to make it commercial. You write whatever you want as far as the way that you handle the story, and it's the worst of times because the main houses who have millions and millions of dollars that they have to be concerned about, stockholders, all these sorts of things, they have to find something that they think is going to make the money back that they're going to invest in it. And if you invest $50,000 to $100,000 in a title, you want to make sure that you get that much money back and maybe more. In a first novel, they rarely do that well. So while they're trying to make hits, they're trying to do series, all those kinds of things to get their money back. But you know, you're absolutely right. This does seem to me to be a very interesting time for artists because the cost of production is very low. The cost of printing one copy at a time might be kind of high, but that particular cost is going down to the point where these folks in Seattle who have given me my shot are able to afford it.
So if you go to this website, what you will find is an opportunity either to buy the book in paperback, not hardback, but paperback,
right.
or if you want to print out however many pages long it is, to buy it in PDF form.
Right.
There is a short sample on there that you can read for
right.
free, but if you want the entire thing to in PDF form that you can keep as a file on your computer or print on your printer, then that is also a nominal fee.
And this is what most of the people in publishing are looking at today as the future business model. Because of the cost of overhead involving the major houses in New York City, the conglomerates that want, you know, a huge return on their bottom line, they are looking for ways of cutting cost. And the ebook, while it has been in form for several years now, the success of the ebook has never really taken off because of the display of the ebook on the handheld models that are currently available. Sony has a handheld model. Several other people are coming out with handheld models. Google is coming out with a new device that's a handheld device that's about the size of a paperback page. And the problem is they're not as bright as a piece of white paper at this point. And until we get a handheld electronic device that is looks like a sheet of paper, has the same kind of texture maybe even, and has the brightness of a sheet of paper, it's going to be very difficult to get people to read off of a computer screen or a handheld device like a Trio or a Palm or any of those kind of things.
It seems like all handheld computer devices right now are difficult on the eyes, especially
yeah.
the older you get. It's
exactly.
hard to read some cell phones. It's hard to read some Blackberries. It's hard to for me to play some of the little games that are on the handheld devices just because I really cannot see well enough to manipulate it well enough to win the game.
Judge Fogg has been sold to a couple of websites who do just that. They sell novels for people to read on palm-sized cell phones or the PDAs. I would go blind trying to read it. off of that. But young people are used to that. That's the way they do their messaging. They do their text messaging. It's completely comfortable for them to do that. For me, it's unfathomable to me that anybody could even do that. But apparently, those sites are doing very well. I think one is called Mobi Pocket, M-O-B-I Pocket. And it's basically a reselling in a new format of my book so that it goes into your cell phone.
Okay, now back to the website that Judge Fogg is on. Who is going to be the audience for this? I mean, who goes surfing the web looking for unheralded authors' books to read? No offense intended.
Well, I don't know. I've tried to do some promotion on my own. Family and friends, I've sent out email blasts to a bunch of folks, and I've had some response. I don't question response because, again, I don't think I'd want to read it off a computer screen. I wrote it on a computer screen, but I'm not sure I'd want to sit for 4 or 5 hours and read it off a computer screen. If you buy it in PDF form, you can, of course, print it out on a piece of paper if you want to, but it seems kind of redundant. But I don't know. I think that there are probably some sites that do better than others in the sense that they do particular genres. My understanding is that, and I've seen this on a couple of websites, the people who write romance fiction and historical romance fiction, there's a tremendously fast turnover in those particular titles. In other words, if you write a series, let's say, your title may only be in bookstores for 3 months. And I understand that those titles sometimes will go through their 3-month cycle and come off, and then they'll go into a PDF form. And people who are, say, following a series, you've read 1 and 2 and you want to see 3 and 4, but you missed it at the bookstore, then you can go to this particular site and download that book into a PDF file, and you can keep up with that particular series. So I can see where that would be beneficial, just as if you wanted to watch a DVD of Lost from last year. It's the very same situation. I missed 4 episodes of Lost, so I need to get disc 3 from last year, or on DVRs and things like that that people will watch television that they miss. So it's a way, I think it's a way of kind of filling in the gaps for something like that. I know that there's a lot of science fiction stories that are told and are uploaded and are on certain web pages. Naturally, the people that are going to be really into computers are probably going to be science fiction fans. Nothing wrong with that. A lot of what's called alternative history, a lot of those kinds of books are on there. And I think that they are probably have more potential for success at this point than someone who's writing literature like I am. But there's nothing wrong with being on the ground floor, and I really feel like this is the ground floor involving literature like this.
Well, I hate to pigeonhole Judge Fogg, but if you were to characterize it in terms of a genre, what would you call it?
It is literary fiction in the sense that it does not fit in a particular kind of thriller, science fiction, romance, any of those kinds of places in the bookstore.
It's not even a crime drama, although you start out with the man in handcuffs. It really
True.
Takes you through an entire life's history of this fictional protagonist of yours. It's not a crime drama per se.
It is more in the vein of a story like Light in August or a William Faulkner or when I was asked for promotion, they asked me a bunch of questions about when they thinking about promoting it. And they said, what kind of book do you think yours is like? And I said, Confessions of Nat Turner. I said, Taft by Ann Paget. I said, I can't remember. There were some other titles that I had read and liked and felt like my book was kind of in that category. So in that sense, it's literary fiction. It's a story about African-American characters written by a person who is white in the South. And so in that sense, I felt like I was able to capture those characters because of my experience and growing up in this area and that sort of thing. So I was thinking in terms of a book kind of like To Kill a Mockingbird, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, who is this man, Judge Fogg? I think we've teased the audience enough about him. Who is this man?
He is a character, but in my mind, he's very real. He's a person who, at a very young age, decides that he is going to make a difference in his community. And he sees from the front porch of his grandmother's apartment in the projects in South Nashville terrible things going on that he thinks he can make a difference with. And so he grows up and determines that he is going to be in the law enforcement community. He becomes a police officer at a time in Nashville when an African-American police officer was rare in the 1950s and 60s. This is set mostly in the late 50s up through the middle to late 80s. And so there's a good deal of information about the civil rights movement and that sort of thing. So he, early on, is ambitious. He wants to make a difference. He believes that he can make a difference. And so he goes to school. He does well in school. And he goes into the police academy, becomes one of the few African-American police officers in Nashville at that time. And he swims upstream. He's dealing with a lot of prejudice, a lot of problems inside the community of police officers, along with being a police officer of the African-American persuasion in the world out in Nashville.
And he comes up from absolutely nothing, becomes a police officer, and at some point a cousin suggests that he might want to go to law school.
Right.
And apparently he does, because he went on to become a judge.
Exactly.
But somewhere along the way, he runs afoul of those high ideals that he looked to during his childhood.
There's a quote in the book that he uses several times, and it says, "The corruption of the best is the worst." And I really believe that. And the problem with this character, and what I was kind of exploring in this particular story, was that thought process. Let's say that we have someone who is caught with their hand in the till. The question that I, and we see this in newspapers and TV stories all the time, someone who is of well thought in the community, someone who has a position of power, all of a sudden there are TV cameras in their front door and they're wanting to know, well, where did the $3 million go? Well, how does a person get there? To me, that's the question I had. How did you get there? Because you obviously had some sense of yourself very early on that you can make a difference. So I created this character with the idea of exploring that idea. How did this person get there? How did they get caught with their hand in the till like that?
How did Congressman Jefferson from Louisiana end up with $900,000 in the freezer?
How did State Senator Ford end up with $800,000 in questionable donations, or whatever you want to call it? And how did all this happen on the state capitol under the noses of a lot of people? Anyway, I wanted to explore that through this character who had a great good idea, a great good ambition. And the problem that this character ran into was the idea that the ends justify the means. He came into a situation where he was able to take advantage of a tragedy. And he took that particular opportunity, used the resources from that opportunity. And his justification for that was, well, this person didn't need this dirty money. I'm going to take this dirty money and make it something that I can use to better myself. And by bettering myself, I'm going to better the community. And so that's what he does.
At some point, you off the air, you compared this to Othello.
True.
On some level. In what ways does this parallel the Othello story?
I think it. I studied Othello before I really got into reading this, and the thing I was taken with Othello was a man who had great ambition but had a flaw in his insecurities. And I think that this is something that Judge Fogg has a problem with also, in the sense that he comes from nothing, as you said. He has no resources at all when he's 6 years old, when we're first introduced to him. But he has this notion that he can become something. And so I feel like Othello is that same kind of character. His cousin, Charles's cousin, Asa, in my mind, is an Iago kind of character, in the sense that he is jealous of Charles and basically wants what Charles has.
He's not as good looking as Charles. He has a club foot.
Exactly. He's handicapped. He's physically handicapped when Charles is a physical specimen. He plays high school football. He gets all the girls. He plays basketball, all these sorts of things that Asa can't do. And so there's a feeling of insecurity in Asa that is quelled by his undermining Charles, by his behavior. And so while they are family, they're in conflict. And while Asa is also driven to try to make the world better, he takes what he feels is a spiritual journey because of the writings of a leader very much like I liken the character to be somewhere in the range between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, somewhere in between those two with traits of those same. And that particular character is assassinated in front of Asa. Asa is forever scarred, forever injured by witnessing that. And so he becomes a tragic character in the sense that while his ambition was similar to Charles, he didn't have the same opportunities that Charles had to find a way to bring those ambitions to fruition. So he takes a very negative point of view to the world and toward Charles and becomes Charles's greatest antagonist.
He figures, I mean, to hell with playing by the rules, all bets are off. They killed my hero. What else is there but to play the game?
In a real sense, he plays Iago to Othello in this, in that he feels like he can be an outlaw because his cousin is on the police force. He's got it. By family ties, Charles has to look out for him, and that Asa can do whatever he wants to do because he knows that if he gets in too big a trouble, that Charles will always bail him out. And that's what happens throughout much of the story. Asa becomes a drug addict. He becomes an alcoholic. He loses his faith in a real world and in a real way, and he transforms just as Charles transforms.
Did it ever cross your mind that an African-American reader, if they know you're white, might say, how does this guy know these characters and this world, and where does he get off trying to capture it?
I did think of that. I was concerned about that. I'm still concerned about that. What can I do about it, though? I mean, I just feel like I can only do the best that I can do. I know that there may be some feelings of resentment. I know that there may be some problems in the future if this becomes a big hit. I know that my intentions were good in the exploration of this particular story. And I felt like I couldn't have told it through the eyes of a white American in Nashville in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s in the same way. The dynamic would have been different.
You do know Nashville and you do know Middle Tennessee.
Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. I don't know what it's like to be a black person, but I have been discriminated against. I have felt alienated. I have felt depressed because of who I am, the way I look, that sort of thing. Everybody has. Everybody can relate to that. So there are certainly parallels that I feel with Charles just because I am who I am.
You write in dialect also, at least in the start of the
right.
book where you are having his grandmother speak.
Right.
Did that also cross your mind as something that might raise some eyebrows?
It did, and I shy away from using a lot of that. Once we get past their initial introduction, Charles, of course, is educated, just as Asa is educated, and the dialect goes away, the slang pretty much goes away, and I make a point of trying to make them sound as intelligent and knowing and sensitive as possible without relying to street slang or that sort of thing.
Also, there's some concern or has been some concern raised by some African-Americans whenever an African-American politician is indicted or alleged to have been involved in some sort of corruption, that, well, basically the white power structure couldn't stand to see a black man succeed, and therefore he was set up, he was framed. I'm not saying that the suspicion occurs in all cases,
sure.
Nor am I saying that it happens in all cases, and I'm not saying that a certain amount of suspicion is without credence. All you have to do is look at American history and understand why people would be suspicious of of things happening in that way. Did that ever cross your mind?
The initial corruption, to me, is a youthful indiscretion, a thinking that the money that is found that fuels Charles's education, the money that was found and used to better him through his education, that sort of thing. To me, that was a young person who has more ambition than they do common sense at that point. They see something and they grab for it. Later in the book, Charles knows better. And in a real sense, he's become corrupted by the system that he is involved in. There's so much compromise and give and take in that system. And so much is trading back and forth that I really believe that it's very difficult for anyone not to become compromised in that system if they're in it for a very long time. So as Charles becomes a police officer and then becomes a prosecutor and then eventually becomes a judge, I just think that the day-to-day grind of that kind of pushes down the good, positive attitude that you might have about life and makes you more easily compromised. And in a real sense, this story is about someone who wants to do good. And even though in the end he ends up in shackles and in handcuffs, he is still someone, even at that point, feels as though he can still do good.
Oh, the situation that you just described, the emotions that a character goes through in that regard, are more the emotions and the circumstances that can happen to every man or every woman, regardless of race. What I thought of, as you've been talking here, is as a quasi-parallel. It doesn't fit in every step-by-step scene, is Willie Stark from All the King's Men.
Exactly.
Who started out with good intentions and then along the way began saying, I'm just like one of you Hicks, and rose to dominate those quote-unquote Hicks on the basis of that populist appeal.
True. And his downfall was basically because of his weaknesses that he could not deal with in a positive way. And I think that, again, going back to the system, I think the system is the best that has ever been created. The American justice system, when it works, is ideal because it not only brings law and order to society, it dispenses justice, which is, when you think about it, an extraordinary idea. It's not an eye for an eye. It's not if you cut me off in traffic, I find a way to follow you home and beat you to death. If a police officer is called into a situation, there's the law, and then when you get into the court system, there's order to it. And as I said before, I believe that this is an extraordinarily wonderful and positive system, but the corruption of the best is always the worst, and I really wanted to explore what that was like. And that's basically the theme of this particular story. The characters that I chose, I felt like this was the best way of portraying that.
Well, now what do you do? Do you just sit back and watch the money roll in?
No.
Do you keep writing? And if you write in the future, will you use this very same publisher?
I like Renee. She's doing a wonderful job. She's been very supportive. I have another manuscript that she's looking at, so there's no question that I trust her judgment. I'd like to be at a big house. I'd like to be, on book tour. I'd like to have a $1 million movie contract when somebody wants to adapt a story of mine into a film. I'd like to write the screenplay for it. That's why I learned how to write screenplays. But you take what you get when you get it. And there's no reason or problem that has come up in my mind and in my life that time can't seem to figure out. And while the time may be right for the publication of this book in this form right now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, nobody knows what's going to happen. But it wasn't ready 10 years ago, or maybe the world wasn't ready 10 years ago.
The name of the book is Judge Fogg. It is available right now at literaryroad.com, and the author is Randy O'Brien.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Of course, you work here. Why would you not be here? This is Jenna Logue. This is MTSU on the Record. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Go to mtsunews.com and check out the podcast. And we're also on iTunes.